Then let's get started. So our topic for this morning started out as the ketubah in court. And then as I was preparing it, it was based on an article I did for a B'nai B'rith program a few years ago. But as I was preparing it, I went in a couple other directions with it as well. So it's kind of a little broader than the question of the acceptability of a ketubah in civil court. What I want to do is start out, as you see the headings on a different part of the sheet, by looking at the finances, as I put it on the sheet, the balanced finances of a Jewish marriage. Is that in fact a vision? And then move from that into the ways in which the ketubah helps to create that kind of balance. And then obstacles to enforcing the ketubah in a civil court, because elements of the ketubah, even if the goal of this kind of balanced and open type of finances is there, there are technical elements of the ketubah that just don't match. So so those are the three areas that I'd like to address. I'm still not sure what I want to do for our last year for next week, but we'll, you know, God willing, figure something out. Okay, so the finances of a Jewish marriage. So the ideal seems to be to have shared property. And that becomes clear in the Tanaim. The Tanaim have language which we're going to get to inside shortly, but if you want to already see it, if you look at the first source from Rabbi Shlomo Daichovsky, you look at the second paragraph, the words that I underlined, that long underline. You see that? V'yishlatu? V'yishlatu b'nechseyon shava b'shava. They shall control their assets equally. V'al yavrichu v'al yalimu lo ze mizu v'lo zu mizeh. They shall not be mavriach. To be borech is to flee. To be mavriach is to make flee. They should not hide their assets from each other. Kim yadu ba'avo ve'at v'chiba. They should live in love and camaraderie. That's a goal. And it tells us a lot about what our vision is. Now, the truth of the matter is, there is a machlokes as to whether this is actually meant as a binding statement, or whether it's just a nice idea. Is it poetry? Poetry has value as well. But there's a debate in Israel regarding the issue of an egalitarian approach to finances within a marriage. And is that something that is a Jewish ideal or not? Rav Shlomo Daichovsky makes the argument that this can indeed be seen as part of Jewish tradition. And you see it in source number one, from an article of his in the 18th volume of Tchumen, asking the question of how we look at an egalitarian approach to marital finances. He says, Halachat hashituf eina yitzirat yesh me'ayin. He says, the idea that you are shutafin, that you are partners in the property of the marriage, that protocol is not something that civil society created, something from nothing. He says, it's simply an expansion on an existing philosophy that you have. And frankly, it's what people want. And he quotes you from a psak din from the Israeli civil court system. And I jumping to where I underlined, Shutavut zu nigzeret migmirat hadat hamiyucheset litzdadim. The idea that they are partners. What compels us to think that that's what's going on? He says it's a we understand that to be the mindset of the two partners. It is learned from the circumstances of life lived together. Living together generates the chazaka that in fact they are living as partners. And he then says, you can find the source for this in the language of the Tanaim that we read out before about controlling all their assets together and not hiding their assets from each other. And he says, you know, the Marie Colon actually relied on this. Marie Colon dealt with a terrible case. It was a case in which a woman was accused by her husband of infidelity. And so the man tries to wrest control of all the assets from her. And the Ma'arik says you can't do that. If you take a look after the underline in the second paragraph, Bistamecha Piskazu, Biksava Tanoim, relying on that clause within the Tanoim, Hitila Maharik Kherma Bal Shevriach Nechasim Meisho. So the Ma'arik put a husband in Kherim for trying to get all his assets away from his wife, and he said, Lola Bayeshain Yachal Lispos Nidun Yasa Shechni Sehi. Not only is he not able to take away the property she brought into the marriage, Elafilu Mashechnis. Even when he brought in any Yochel Lispos, he is not able to claim that. Kal Menas Kein Machnisim Hanadunyos. He says, that's the understanding when you bring property into a marriage. Sheyenu Me'em Abal V'Yisha Yachad. They will both benefit from it together. Not to mention, the property is to be used for the wife's food and the wife's support. The Koshkin Beyos Hatanoim Mubu'arim Beinem Sheish Tushneim Shavla B'Shava, etc. He says, not to mention the Tanoim say it, which is very interesting because you always wonder about the language of a document like the Tanoim. The Tanoim are not like a Ksuba, right? The Ksuba, number one, has a very, very old pedigree, and number two, is a serious legal document. Tanoim, more or less, in our circles, are a joke. You know, it's not a joke. It's a nice opportunity to honor people. We should not call it a joke because then no one will want to sign on the Tanoim anymore. But realistically, I mean, if I had to ask the people who are here in the room, all of whom were halachically married, you know, where are your Tanoim? Anybody have any idea? Including those who were married in the last decade?
I think it's somewhere.
Hey, I think it's somewhere. I could have told you that. I mean, who in the world? So you always wonder, I always wonder, where did the Tanoim come from? Ivan, do you know where your Tanoim are?
I don't know.
Okay, I was curious. I thought he was raising his hand. Oh. I wonder, like, how old is the language? Well, the answer is the Maharik, who is 14th or 15th century, evidently has the language that we have, at least on this line. I don't know if he has all the Yalav Yitzmachs and everything else. He probably had more, you know, given where he lived.
I was told it wasn't an honor to sign on a Tanoim, because in actual fact, it's almost like an orif. That in the event people can't, you are subject to.
So that depends on what the role is. I'm not so sure that that's the role of the Edom to the Tanoim. I think that's just the fathers are stuck with that role.
Oh, is that?
Yeah. But in any case, the point is that the Ma'arik takes that line as in fact a commitment from the parties. The Ma'arsham. As well, did I bring the Marsham? The excerpt with the Marsham? Yeah, I did, in the bottom part. Before I get to that, though, sorry, the third paragraph in number one. Omnam ha-marik enu medabar al-haknas bailus le-isha b'nechsei ha-baal el-araka l-isir ha-vracha. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. The Marik is not saying that the wife is a 50% owner of the husband's assets. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that the husband should not hide the existence of the assets from the wife. But the key element that we deduce here, I should have underlined that as well, is that we read the mind of the people who entered into this marriage to say, we think that that's the mindset, that you're not supposed to be hiding stuff. He expects she won't hide stuff, she expects he won't hide stuff. Which includes the property that he brought into the marriage himself. Even though from a technical standpoint, she doesn't own that property, right? She has all sorts of rights to support from him in one flavor or another. She doesn't own the property he brought into the marriage. Technically speaking, he could keep that property away from her as long as he maintains his full support of her, pays the ksuba when it's appropriate, and so on. Nonetheless, his point is, we look at the mindset of the husband and wife and say, they want to share when they come into the marriage. That is their expectation. And so he argues, our day is not the same as what it was classically. Okay, Nyesh Makom Lamar, there's room to suggest. Im ha'omdina b'yameinu nisravcha yoser, v'enika le'isha shlita mamashit v'nechsei ba'ala, if the popular mindset today, in fact, gives women control of the husband's assets, ein b'kach stira l'halacha, that doesn't contradict halacha, because halacha accepts that sort of evolution. He then quotes you the tshuva of the Maharsham. Dun b'matanasa shal gevir al achosa b'lo yidiyas bala. There was a woman who gave her sister property without the husband knowing. And in support of his ruling that in fact her gift is valid, he brought the Marik's view. Saying that when the Tanoim say they control the assets together, that's what it means. And he added, it could be they didn't write that historically. I mean, Shulchan Aruch is post-Ma'arik. It could be they didn't write that historically, but he says we write it now, and he says, yeah, that fits. Harei lanu sheshlitas bnei hazug benachasim mishtana mitkufa. The tkufa, Sardakovsky argues, it changes over time. Now, the issue of changing over time and all that is fascinating in its own right, but I bring this more or less to know Rav Dakovsky's position is that equal management of finances is a given. That's his position. Rav Avram Sherman thought that was a very creative idea, far too creative. He says not everybody agreed with this position, and he quotes you of Yitzchak Shmalkus, the Beis Yitzchak, at the end of the 19th century in support of another view. If you look in the second paragraph in number 2, Beshut Beis Yitzchak, I have an Ezer Aleph Kufyud, Nistabik Betokef Nusham Shal Tanoim Rak Yishutu B'Nechseh and Shava B'Shava Karach Kalara. He wasn't so sure that line in the Tanoim is actually halachically meaningful. Im Hadin Kein Be'emes, this is now quoting from the Beis Yitzchak, Im Hadin Kein Be'emes She Yishutu B'Nechseh and Shava B'Shava Ha'ol Amasin Kein Be'Ferish, bless you, do we say that in fact that's what we mean, that they should control their property equally since they made such an explicit condition? O'en Kozum Kein Rak L'Shur for the Shtara, or is it only sure for the shtar, it's a nice thing to put into a document. Dilich ora, kevan shabam nosin ksuba, hua shalit b'nechazim, v'yishayinu chola ha'akev, rakim v'vazbez b'nechazim. He says, first of all, the husband's responsible to pay her, right, the ksuba. So that means he controls the assets. And the only thing she can do is, if he's spending all his money such that the ksuba will not be there anymore to be paid, then she has a right to object. But that's it. And further, they write these tanoim before the chuppah. I mean, we do it, you know, 20 minutes before the chuppah. But historically, people did it months before. If you don't restate your condition close to the time of nisuin, then who's to say that it's still binding? Conditions need to be restated. We talked about this a little bit when we talked about kedushin al tanai. The Tanai is not automatically binding for the Nisuin. The Beis Yitzchak felt that, no, this idea of the equal control, lav davka. Rav Shlomo Kluger also dealt with this. He dealt with this regarding the very popular question of tzedakah. If you read further in the article by Rav Sherman, I didn't bring it here, but he quotes a tshuva by the Chabal and Bana'imim, as in Rav Yehuda Lev Graubart of Toronto, Canada, he writes, in case you weren't sure. So on the same issue, the question of, are you allowed to accept a donation from the woman in a marriage given without the husband's assent? Maybe even without the husband's knowledge. This is a very old halachic discussion. So he says in the position of Rav Shlomo Kluger addresses this issue. If you take a look at the third paragraph in number 2, Mashinistapek bo haritzchak shmalkas hayabaru pashat l'Rav Shlomo Kluger. He said Rav Shlomo Kluger thought that it was obvious that specifically that clause is not for real. L'daito baru pashat she'en liros benusuch zet nai mechayev. You don't look at that language as an actual condition that's binding on the parties. Bracha. You're writing a nice bracha. Oh, they should have a wonderful life together. They should all, you know, share their assets together. And every Friday afternoon, they should go for a walk and so on. Hudanim muter likach minashim tztaka b'li rishus b'ilim. Rav Shlomo Kluger dealt with the question of whether you can receive tztaka from a woman without her husband's participation. Someone, in fact, had said, you should permit it. Because after all, the Tanoim say that they control the assets equally. Someone had said that. Rav Shlomo Kluger thought that was very funny. He said, that's shocking to suggest such an idea. He says, this is a known issue, this discussion of accepting such tzedakah. And the answer is no. You can't just overturn that. And he goes on to say, it's just shofrei d'shtara, it's a nice thing, it's a bracha when you write it, it's about living with shalom and achdus. And then where I underlined, v'imnomer nudayik v'lashon hazeh davka, and even if you're going to tell me that this language is for real, they're going to control their assets together, even if you're going to tell me that that language is literal, he says what it means is they will control each one their personal property that they brought into the marriage. I think that that's hard to read with shava b'shava. I don't really think that that works with shava b'shava, but nonetheless, that's his first read. He has more than that. Or it means they will control the assets that she brought into the marriage equally. Not the stuff that is assigned to him. And he says also the word shavet doesn't have to mean shavet. Gam yesh lomar hakavana shal b'shavet shehu lo yaseh b'liatzasa v'ilo taseh b'liatzasa v'avi hakavana lehafach. He says maybe b'shavet actually just means when they dispose of property, they take the other person's opinion into consideration. But not, just the opposite, not that they have joint control, but they have a separate control. And yeah, you should, you know, it's nice to get the other person's thoughts on your decision before you decide that you're going to repaint the house. The Sherman goes on at length to discuss the whole issue of equal shlita and so on. You could have really made the entire shiur his article. He has quite a bit to say. But what's interesting to me here, and the part that makes me want to use this as the foundation for the shiur, is that even if we follow Rav Sherman regarding equal control, and we say that, as Rav Shlomo Kluger said, it's separate, and at most they're just consulting with each other, no one can deny the basic goal of Al Yavrichu V'Al Yalimu. Right? The basic goal is peaceful management of the finances of the family, cooperation, working together, even if it's not, you know, fully implemented. And that's what we would like to do. And the Ksuba is a critical part of trying to create that balance. And here I bring a source number 3, which I think speaks to that point, even though it was originally written for a separate purpose. From Reb Broid's article, New York State Regulation of Jewish Marriage in the Family and Law Review, I use this. Jeff, you were there last night for my Shira Desh?
Yes.
Yeah, so I used this in that shiur as well, but I think I ran through it there because we didn't have a lot of time. So now you get to hear it. It's about the ksuba as covenant versus the ksuba as contract. Right? This is something we think about a lot, but I like the way he frames it, where you're at a wedding and everyone is treating the ksuba as a ritual document with religious significance, but the truth of the matter is that when you stop and explain this is what the ksuba says, you realize, no, it's financial. He has a whole bunch of obligations to her that will be triggered once she agrees to marry him. So he writes in number 3, on the one hand, Jewish tradition is replete with references to the sacred nature of the marital relationship. The Talmud recounts that a person is not complete until he or she marries, is not even called a person until two are united. But the incorporation of godliness, sanctity, and covenant into the union is but one facet of marriage in the Jewish tradition. The tradition also presents a countervailing set of factors that provide insight into the nature of Jewish marriage. The Jewish law mechanics of entry into and exit from marriage are rooted in private contractual rights. Central to this model is the rabbinic tradition of the ksuba, the premarital contract to which the couple agrees that spells out the terms and conditions of both the marriage and its termination. This tradition, discussed in dozens of pages of closely reasoned Talmudic texts, including an entire tractate titled Ketubot, describes marriage as a contract that is freely entered into by both parties and dissolvable by divorce with little sacred to it. So the ksuba, yes, we view it as covenant, but on the other hand, it's contract, and it really does, I think, try to create this balance in the finances of marriage, even if, again, it's a non-literal, non-legally binding, there's a better term for that probably, type of a balanced approach. Okay, so that's our first stage. how does the ksuba actually do this? So I compare the ksuba with a secular marriage contract. The Law Society of Ontario used to be known as the Law Society of Upper Canada. And I looked at the 2012 study guide for people applying to the bar. And they said a marriage contract really must include the following things. I'm going to quote them later on. This is not from the quote, that's later. But number one, it includes ownership / division of property. Number two, spousal support obligations. Number three, it can include the right to direct the education and moral training of children, but not the right of custody or access to children. That doesn't belong in a marriage contract. And any other rights and obligations that they want to include. The ksuba is much more elaborate in terms of the details that it tries to provide, even if a lot of what's in there can fit into one of these categories. We'd had a shiur months ago, I think Rabbi Abbey gave the shiur, on whether ksuba is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan, its relationship with the mohar, and so on. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this now, but just the basic background. In the Chumash, we refer to a mohar payment that goes from the man to the woman, the woman's family, and it seems to be at the time of the wedding. I noted at the time, I sent that in a link to, you know, after the shiur, that the Muslims have this thing called mohr. M-O-H-R, as it's written in English, and seems to be basically an equivalent of that. This was a cultural thing. Vimarin ksuvas yudam and aleph in source number 4 has a machlokes regarding whether we view the requirement of the ksuba as de'oraisa or de'rabanan. The de'oraisa basis would indeed be the mohar thing at its root, at the earliest, and the de'rabanan would be something based on the mohar. So the Gemara says, idmar amar of nachon amar shmuel mishum mishum ben elazar chacham tignulam dos yisrael lebsula masayim ula amon amon. The chachamim are the ones who said 200 or 100. The Rabbanan Tana Ho'aluk Nas Chacham Hilo Sigba Elamen Aziboris. We have a brisa that says that since it is a knas, a fine of the Chachamim, therefore you can pay it out of the cheapest property. To which the Gemara says, Knasa, my Knasa. Who called it a fine? Whatever your opinion is on marriage, you can't call the ksuba a fine. It's not a penalty for having gotten married. The Ela Eima Ho V'Takanas Chachamim Hilo Sigba Elamen Aziboris. You're right. We didn't mean knas. You meant takana. It's an enactment of the Chachamim. Rabbi Shimon Ben Gamliel Amar Ksuba Skisha Min HaTorah. He says it's a da'oraisa. To which the Gemara says, what? V'atanya, I have a braisa. Kesef yishkol kemora habesulos, sheyezeh kemora habesulos, mor habesulos kazeh, mikan samchacham l'ksubas isha min HaTorah. The Tanakhama, that when this braisa says that the Chachamim said ksuba is min HaTorah because of Mohar. And Rav Shimon Gamliel himself said, no, ksubas isha ainu midivrei Torah, ela midivrei sohum, it's a derabanan. Yeah, epoch, flip it. Well, why do you flip the second source? Why do you flip the first source? Why do you insist that Rishon Gamliel says it's d'oraisa? And the answer is, because I have another source that indicates that he says you have to use the money from Kaputkia, the better currency, so we think that he really does believe it's a d'oraisa. Rabbeinu Tam argues that it is, in fact, d'oraisa. In Tosfos on that Gemara, in source number 5, where was it? One second. Right, there it is. Might as well read it from the beginning of the Tosfos, it's not that much. The mashma de ksuba de rabbanan, right? When he said chacham tiknu, it sounds like the ksuba is de rabbanan. V'chein be'isha rabba, he quotes the Gemara Nivamos, gabe ein la ksuba ka'amar mai time of the kiddo rabbanan ksuba, shlote kalabe nev lo tziyah, etc. The Gemara there says, why did the rabbanan create ksuba? It sounds like it's a de rabbanan. Alma stama de hashas, sabre de ksuba de rabbanan. V'kasha, denaga lichtov de ksuba kesev zuzei masan de chazi lechi mide oraisa. This is the problem. The language in the ksuba says the 200 zuz that you deserve biblically. V'omar Rabbeinu Tam, the samchino Rishon ben Gamliel. He says, yeah, Rabbeinu Tam says that we follow Rishon ben Gamliel, who indeed says that you have to pay out of the most kaputkia, which indicates that he believes that it's a de'el raisa. So we're following Rishon ben Gamliel. And then the Reis said, that we don't say that. We end up saying, no, it's actually a derabanan. And as far as the language of the chazalechi midoraisa, we can work on that. We can play with that language. Don't worry about that. But that's Rabbeinu Tam's position, whereas the Rosh disagrees, and I brought him for you in number six, where he says the point of the word midoraisa is about the quality of the coins. It's not about that you have a right to this payment mid oraisa. Your right to the payment is mid rabbanan. That's the position of the Rush. Everybody agrees there's at least one part of the ksuba that's derabanan, which is in source number 7, the lien on the man's property. That's a takana of Shimon ben Shetach. The idea that all his property from the time of the marriage is encumbered for payment of the ksuba is indeed a derabanan. For an interesting note on this, I didn't bring the link on the sheet. I ought to have. There's an article by Dr. Yoel Shiloh on the Bar Ilan website, where he talks about how the various ksuba payments involved, the ksuba, the tosafes, and all that, have evolved over time. It's a short article. If anyone's interested, I can give you the link. But that's the basic idea. Is in general we pass in against Rabbi Tam. We generally assume the ksuba, in fact, is a derabanan. The ksuba records 3 biblical obligations of sher, ksus, va'ona. Those obligations are indeed d'oraisa. And then, aside from the ksuba payment, we have a whole bunch of other d'rabbanan payments. Medicine, ransom, burial, support after his death, support for her unmarried daughters after his death, and inheritance of her ksuba payment by her sons that come from this marriage as opposed to the sons from another marriage. I gave you... No, I didn't. I thought I gave you... Why is number 8 there? What did I do? Okay, ignore number 8 and jump to number 9. I don't know why I put number 8 there. Hang on 1 second. Yeah, no, number 8 doesn't belong there. Number 8 belongs in a later discussion. I apologize. It's staying there on the sheet. I'm not printing new ones right now, but we'll come back to it. Number, yeah.
Well, it's based on the question here in number 8, but it applies to before. This
okay.
is all contract.
Yes.
Well, let's say you say that you have to have the two to look at the other.
Yeah.
So, what's better, getting married to halacha, then you lose the ketubah, or you never had a ketubah, or just have a ketubah, but you never get married to halacha?
I don't understand. What do you mean by that?
This is, what's the tzad to say that you need the ketubah to look at it? It's contract. You got married to halacha.
Right, it's not about it being a marriage contract. Rather, you know, let's come back to when we get to number 8. Because even though we're up to number 8, we're not up to number 8. Let me just go through it in order and then come back to that. It's a good question. I'm just going to lose the flow otherwise. The oldest known surviving ketubah, at least known to me, is the ketubah of Babata, and I gave you a link so you can look it up online. It's from the 1st, 2nd century Common Era. There are hundreds of ksuvos found from the Cairo Geniza as well, going back to the 6th century, and they include these Tanai Basin. You know, the Tanai Basin that we're talking about are actually in the text of their ksuvos. One thing that I always like to include when discussing what is included in the ksuba, it has nothing to do with the rest of the shir, but it's too good not to, is source number 10. We'll go through it a little quickly, but it's too good not to include. It's the Rush's tshuva. Reuven lava mishimon milva bishtar. Reuven borrowed money from Shimon, a full, properly documented loan. And he wrote in the document, all my property is encumbered for this, all the property I'm going to acquire is encumbered to it, metalta, gamer karkoi, everything, movables, land, the whole bit. Then he went away, he went and gave all his property away as a gift to relatives. Left himself nothing. He lives in this relative's house. He eats at his table. He eats and drinks. He's wearing nice clothing. He doesn't go to work. He doesn't want to do anything. None of the investments or business that he was doing beforehand is he at all interested in doing now. Because he knows whatever he makes is going to his creditor. And the creditor is obviously very angry. And as he goes through, the creditor wants the Beis Din to make the borrower swear that he's going to pay the debt from whatever he gets in the future, and that he's going to get a job. So he brings proof that you can force the guy to get a job from the following. Baby Raya, Michuva Lagon, Shahor, Shachai, Vadam Haskir, Atzmok, De Lazan, Ezisho. You have to actually get a job in order to support your wife. Mishum Tanai Shes, the Biksuvasa, because it's a Tanai in the Ksuba. Ubal Sefer Amitzvos, needing the smug. Writes Rabbi Leo, Omer Shachai, Vadam Haskir, Atzmok, De Finest, Ezisho, Kamashakasa, Bishtar, Ksuba, Vana, Eflach, Vaokir, Vaezon. Eflach! I'm gonna work. So he has an obligation to get a job. Gam kein lo vezeh shehisna mashakasa b'shtar chayv lefitzna kfitzna. So too, the person who entered into this loan. That's the argument made to the Rush. So the Rush responds, tshuva. Umashatoin Shimon shiasa malachi teil lefroas chovo ein basin kofenos olakach. He says you can't compel the guy to go get a job in order to pay you. All the Torah says is the only thing you can do is demand collateral out of his property. That's what the Torah licenses you to do. Otherwise, that's called slavery. Right? It's called debtor slavery. You're saying that you have to work in order to pay off your debt to me. Can't do that. As well. However, last paragraph, he says it's not so clear that Rabbeinu Eliyahu was correct that you have to get a job. But he says you can make the argument for that as opposed to other cases of debt based on the language in the Ksuba, if nothing else. So I like the idea that this, the Ksuba includes an obligation to go get a job. I think that that's a good idea to explain to the Chasen and Kala long before the wedding. Interestingly, the way this works is that the husband owes the money to his wife from the start of the marriage, but the payment is done at the end of the marriage with either divorce or the man's death. Originally, the ksuba obligation was due at the time of the marriage, and the Rashba has a fascinating case, which I brought you in number 11. In the interest of time, I'll summarize it, but I brought it for you in number 11. There was a case in which there's a fellow by the name of Reuven who owes 1,000 dinar as a debt. He had taken out a loan for 1,000 dinar. His wife had not signed on the document. The loan was originated during the marriage, so he was already married before the loan. It happens to be a fellow who's not Jewish. So the guy who's not Jewish comes to collect out of Reuven's assets. However, Reuven's wife goes to civil court and says, I have a prior claim. And she collects the ksuba from all of the property that the husband is holding. Apparently, the ksuba is worth more than all of the guy's assets. So so that way, he can't pay his creditor. Well, Reuven doesn't have only one creditor. Reuven has more than one creditor. There's another fellow named Shimon, and Shimon is Jewish, and therefore he knows how things are supposed to work in terms of the ksuba. And he knows the ksuba is supposed to be paid at the end of the marriage, not, you know, at whatever point during the relationship that she decides to collect. So Shimon says to the Jewish court, what are you doing here? She's not able to take the assets away now. I have the right to be able to claim it. Maybe if the marriage ends at some point and there are no assets, then you can go back and because there's a lien on the property that we already mentioned in the Gemara. But right now, that lien is not collectible. And he says, yeah, I think Shimon's correct. Shimon's correct. Who says that the marriage is going to end the way you think it's going to end? Right? She has the ability to sell the rights to her ksuba during the course of the marriage. It could be that she dies before he does. But I thought that was a very interesting attempt that was made. But it highlights the fact that the ksuba payment has moved from the beginning of the marriage to the end of the marriage. And the Rama and Evan Ezer notes, it's not just that, but it's also the payment for the nedunya, for the property that she brings into the marriage. Also, that's only with the ksuba. The husband also parenthetically does gain, not parenthetically, gains financial rights in the course of the marriage. They happen not to be recorded in the ksuba. But he has the right to her product as long as she wants his food. He has the right to usufruct. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I've never asked anyone what the proper pronunciation is. You're a lawyer, you should know.
I don't speak Latin.
Is it Latin?
I don't know.
And usufructus. I don't know. But the usufruct is proceeds from her property. That's what we're talking about. As long as he is committed to ransom her, he gets usufruct, and he inherits her ksuba payment, assuming that he takes care of the burial. So if she predeceases him, that's why there's no ksuba payment, because he's receiving it. Historically, there have been arrangements that a woman could make in order to protect her property from the husband. There was the above board method, and there was the below board method. Right? The above board method was called siluk. And I brought you the lines from the Shulchan Aruch, but I'll state it outside. The Shulchan Aruch, first of all, based on the Gemara in Ksuvos Pei Gimel, says that she is able to disclaim any share in her property. Dinu Dvaram Ein Li B'Nechasayach. I'm sorry, he is able to disclaim any share in her property, saying, Dinu Dvaram Ein Li B'Nechasayach, I have no claim on your property. He's able to do that. It will also affect inheritance. I brought you that as well from that from Ebenezer and Beza, from that same Gemara and Ksuvos Pei Gimel Amud Aleph. However, this can only happen after Kiddushin, because if you do it before Kiddushin, what's the problem? Why can't you do this before Kiddushin?
Kiddushin?
No.
That you could collect potentially from.
No. Sefer Shlomo Bar Leolam. It's not yours yet. You can't disavow ownership of something you don't yet own.
According to Rivera, you could, don't
you? Right, on Devashal Baliola. Right, we don't bask in that way. So the Pesach Choshen has an interesting discussion in Chelek Tes, Perek Ches, footnote Reish Nun, about what about after modern engagement? And do an act of kinyan to be misalik yourself from it. He has a discussion there. There's a tshuva in the Chavos Yarmim Zayin. I didn't bring it in here. But the above board method is the husband doing siluk from those assets after kiddushin. The other option, the below board one, is that she makes a pretense of giving it away before marriage. Right? This is the emoluments discussion going on today in the U.S. Not emoluments, really. Emoluments is about enrichment, but the discussion of whether the president is allowed to own and run his business in the course of the marriage and giving it to other people to run on his behalf. So here, this is the idea of being mavriach one's property with a gift. The Gemara in Ksuvos is in Ayin Ches, Ayin Tes, and the Shulchan Aruch paskins it as well. And basically what we say, as you see in number 14 from the Shulchan Aruch, is that if before getting married she writes a document saying, well, my property goes to so-and-so, that actually works. It's binding, and it is indeed recognized, and the husband is not going to be able to get it from her. So that's in terms of just the financial relationship here and the balance that we're trying to strike. The husband has obligations to the wife. The husband has rights for to what the wife has. There is a sense of some level of balance that is in there, and she has the ability to protect her property. That's what I'm trying to get at here with this, is the balance that we're looking for.
Just some real examples. If Sarah and Avram get married, and before they're married, they each owned a house, and now they're married, so under the suba now, they both own the houses together.
So land that the woman owns when she comes into the marriage, I believe he's able to eat peros from, so he could live in the house, but he's not entitled to, he doesn't own the land, the house. He has no claim to the house.
Okay, and does she have a claim in his house?
She has a claim on being able to live in his property. She does not gain his house either.
Okay. And then, let's say two doctors are married. Their income.
So his income is bound for use for his obligations towards her, whether the more routine, food, clothing obligation, or ransoming her or burying her, whatever it is, those are all duties that he has towards her according to her standard of living that she brought into the marriage. And then what she earns, that's part of what they call, so to speak, normal earnings. He has the right to, but if she goes over and above, and what over and above has evolved over time in terms of how the poskim have looked at it, but if she goes over and above, that's hers to keep.
I'm getting a bit more complicated. So when the right one's owned all these buildings, and built them.
Yeah.
So the wife's had a claim in the first Canadian place.
So again, no, we said not. Only to what he owes to, in terms of his obligations to her, that's all. Correct. Correct. So now, just number 8 was only a side note because it came up in an earlier discussion in Beis Medrash. It doesn't really relate to our topic, but the question came up. We have a requirement in the Gemara that the wife have the ksuba, and in the event that she doesn't have the ksuba, so the Baal is usher to her. that's a basic requirement. And in terms of what you asked before, Jeffrey, the idea is not that the marriage is created by the ksuba. The idea is that she has to have that protection against whimsical divorce or impulsive divorce. So that's what the ksuba provides. The fact that he knows that she has a document that says he owes her all this stuff in the event of divorce is supposed to be a protection for her, and therefore they're usher to each other. What I brought here in number 8 was that there's a footnote in the Ketubah in America by Rabbi Broyden and Rabbi Reese, where they talk about the possibility of other substitutes for the Ketubah, such that even if the Ketubah is lost, they may still be able to live together until a replacement ksuba is written. So he mentions, for example, in number 3, it is while the rabbinical courts require that a photocopy of the ksuba be kept on file in the rabbinical courts. In America, it is not unusual. There will be an actual photograph of the ksuba. And while a photocopy or photograph likely does not allow for the enforcement of the ksuba, it does provide evidence of the factors previously described. Right? So maybe that can be used in order to allow them to continue to live together until a replacement ksuba can be written.
Is that true in America that's required?
That what? No, he doesn't say it's required. Oh. He says that in America it's not unusual. There will be. Just because people take a picture at the wedding, you know, of the people signing the ksuba or whatever.
But it's not on file somewhere.
Right? Correct. Oh. No, it's evidence that there is a ksuba. Uh-huh. That there was a ksuba. That's all. Yeah.
So the couple loses their ksuba. But
yeah,
they happen to have a family law contract, marriage contract, that gives the same protection that the ksuba did. Could they live together?
So if you take a look at number 4, okay, the husband can remit to his wife for safekeeping the monetary value of the ksuba in lieu, there should be a sikh there, of the right to collect. I mean, this article was written in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. I later found it in Truman in Hebrew, in Truman Chaf Hei. But I figured that I had already cut and pasted the English, and for the sake of being a purist, I wasn't going to insist on replacing it with the Hebrew. But the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, Kidarko, was not so careful with typos. But in any case, my point is, in answer to your question, you have the idea of creating a financial substitute for the ksuba. So I would think you should also be able to, you know, if this is good enough, and the Shulchan Aruch Aben Ezra thinks it is, then I don't see why something else that, again, protects her would not be, at least as a stopgap. I think the argument can be made. I'm not posturing. Okay. So this brings us now to the question of, secular court wants us to have a nice balance between the husband and wife. The ksuba has this idea as well of a balance. So could you say then that the ksuba should be something that the secular courts would want to honor and recognize and so forth? And the answer is that we have serious obstacles. There is one overarching obstacle, and then there are three particular problems. The overarching problem is lack of intent to be bound by the ksuba. Which we'll see more of in an article below. Meaning, the couple, when they get married, don't have any intention whatsoever of using the ksuba as a legal document. You can easily address that by making sure that at the wedding, before the thing is signed, before the kinyan is made, you properly explain it, and they say, yes, we agree to be bound by this. But the reality is that doesn't happen. And there have been cases where there has been an attempt made to actually enforce the ksuba in a civil court. And generally speaking, it doesn't go anywhere. I can bring you articles if you want on it. There are some that collect cases where there was an attempt. It's not true that it never worked. But it's a hard sell. It's a really hard sell. In terms of the specific practical problems, so your first problem with trying to do this is the lack of the parties signing the document. If you take a look at source number 15, this is from that barrister licensing process examination study materials document from 2012. The Family Law Act contains the code for domestic contracts, starting with what is required as formal validity. They must be in writing. Okay, it's called a ksuba for a reason. We're good. Signed. Not signed by the edim, signed by the parties. And witnessed. So 2 out of 3. It's in writing and it's witnessed. assuming they recognize that as a signature. But it is not signed by the parties.
Unless they're Italians.
Independent legal advice is not a formal requirement, but it is highly advisable to prevent challenges to the contract on other grounds, right? When the parties say, we didn't know what we were getting into, we didn't get legal advice. Section 56 of the Family Law Act sets out the most common grounds relied upon to set aside a domestic contract in whole or in part. A party to such a contract failed to disclose a significant asset or debt in existence when the contract was formed. A party failed to understand the nature and consequences of the agreement. Any other ground upon which an ordinary contract may be attacked. In other words, any other deficiency that that would be under contract law would be a deficiency. Well, certainly failure to disclose. Yeah. Complete and honest disclosure will eliminate the first ground. Right. It appears that this must include accurate values for assets and liabilities as well as income. Anyone know of a marriage in halacha, you know, a Jewish marriage in which they actually go through with that? However, for cohabitation and marriage agreements, exact values are less important so long as they're still reasonable, right? Standing under the chuppah looking at the ring and saying, yeah, I think it's worth a pruta. I mean, we're not talking about the ring here. We're talking about all your stuff. Independent legal advice will usually eliminate the second, right? I didn't understand the nature and consequences of the agreement. The last basis includes fraud, which is usually a form of non-disclosure, duress, or undue influence. The point being that we have some problems. Number one is that we don't sign it. Of course, you may sign your ksuba, but you have to be careful not to sign it in a way that it looks like you're a witness. You have to be very careful with that on shtaros, on documents in general, that if the parties are signing, they shouldn't sign in a way that it will look like they are the ones who are saying, we saw the following thing take place. So that's something that you'd have to be careful about.
Doesn't it say aid right after the person's name?
Right, so using the word aid can help, but you have to make sure that on with a chasen and kala sign, it says chasen and kala. Uh-huh. The second issue is the issue of disclosure. Financial disclosure, as I understand it, is indeed a requirement in Canadian law. It's not at all a requirement for us. For us, honesty is a requirement. You're not allowed to mislead somebody, right? We have rules of Geneva's Das, obviously. But misleading the other party can have a practical impact, including dissolution of the marriage, right? If you take a look at source number 16 from the classic cases in Kiddushin, Memtes, Memtes. Man says, marry me, Almanash Shani Oshir, on condition that I am wealthy. And he's not. He's an ani. Or on condition that I'm poor, and he turns out to be wealthy. B'chol elu v'adom elahem, because there are a whole bunch of other cases in there. In all such cases, afilu amra believi hayel hiskade shlo afilu hiskai matnai, even if she says, I meant to be married to him even without fulfillment of the tnai, doesn't matter. Eina mekudeshes. Loshnam kibla hi akidushim, loshnam l'shalich l'kablam b'tnai v'shina shalich. No matter how the kiddushin happened, fundamentally the kiddushin are not valid. V'chenim hitato, and so too if she tricked him. Even if he says, I meant to marry her with, you know, irrespective of the condition, eina mekudeshes, it doesn't work. The Rama adds, Ela im kein, amra kein, beferish b'shasa kidushin, v'shama habal v'shasa k'chenim hi hitato, v'amra beferish shava p'shilo halil shaliya kein, kidusha kidushin. Unless the party who was deceived actually said at the time of the marriage, I am marrying without regard for the condition. Right? This goes back a little bit to our discussion of whether conditions that are stated earlier, like in the Tanaim, are by default binding or not binding. But the statement here is that that you have to say at the time of the Kiddushin, I don't care. And otherwise, if you've been tricked, the marriage is not binding. However, it's important to note, if you take a look at, where did I put it? Oh, it's the last line there. The last line in 16. Avam kansa stam v'omar kasever ha'yisi shi kohenes hi levia. Oh, levia v'hi kohenes. Ashir v'yani ani v'hi ashira ha'rezu mekudeshes. If it's only that you made an assumption, the other one didn't trick you. You invented an idea in your head. That's a different story. You know, that doesn't disqualify the marriage. You were just foolish. You should have looked into it. Why is disclosure not necessary from a halachic standpoint? In other words, if we have a concept of mekartos, right, you're not allowed to be cheated. Why don't we say that she should have to disclose to him any debts she has. He has to disclose to her any debts that he has. Why do we not require disclosure in halacha out of concern for mekachtos?
We can maybe have an assumption that for most people, the particular assessment of their assets aren't the determining factor.
You think people don't care? I would argue with that. You don't want to get married to a woman and find out that she owes $1 million in gambling loans. I mean, leave aside gambling because that speaks to a habit. Fine. But you don't want to find out that she owes $1 million in student debt. She got herself 4 PhDs and you never asked her how that happened. So you do care. I think the answer is because in halacha, and this goes back to what we were saying before, they don't assume each other's debts. Meaning whatever debt she brought into the marriage is not going to weigh on his assets. If you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch in number 17, Ein Baal Chov Gova Miksus Ishto Banav Shalova, he's dealing with the case where it's his debt. Right? So if he has a creditor, the creditor is not allowed to go after her clothing or his kids' clothing. And not in clothing that was dyed, colored on their behalf, even if they haven't worn it yet, it's for them, it's theirs. Not new shoes that were bought for them, not books that were bought for his kids to learn from them, that belongs to them. Assuming it's clay hole, it's weekday stuff. Big day Shabbos, Umoed, Govos, and Baal Chov, V'yeshchok, and there's a dispute. What about Shabbos clothing, Yantav clothing? Vein Tzarech Lomer, Mahayuim, Tabaos, Ekleza, V'kesef, Shakol, Baal Chov, V'hu Shekana, La HaBaal. He says there are things that for sure the creditor can take. Rings or whatever. But only if the husband buys it for her. Avamashiach nisalo, but what she brings into the marriage. Whether it is nichsei malo, where he just gets to eat the fruit. Whether it's nichsei tzon barzel, that he's actually getting. Ein balchov gover imenu. The creditor is not allowed to claim it. Im yaduashu mashiach nisahi, o imashiach pasaka baala, bishas nisuin. What if you don't know? That's a different story. But the basic principle is that she is not responsible for his debts, and he is not responsible for her debts. I brought it for you from the Pesach Choshen, because the sources that I had in the Shulchan Aruch were not as clear-cut as what the Pesach Choshen says in number 18. Isha shalav sabayachach nises, if she borrowed money and then got married, im lovech nisa lunachasim eina baal chayv l'shalim, if she didn't bring in any property, the husband doesn't need to pay it. V'avim lech nisa lunachasim, and even if she did bring in, she had a verbal debt in a gova me'abal. Don't claim from the husband. Shabal b'nechse yishto dino kelokeach. He is treated as a buyer. It's only if there was a written document saying that she owes money to somebody. So that's a prior claim. That's before his claim to the assets. That's a different story.
What is that?
That's what we said in number 17. She has no responsibility to his debts.
No, but if she thinks she's got protection by the ksuba, but the guy's really a bankrupt in reality.
And therefore she'll never be able to claim the ksuba because there were standing debts before. And no, that's true. It will affect her in that sense. And fundamentally, you can't get around the fact that it will affect you to be married to somebody who owes somebody $1 million. I mean, right. It's not a good environment for the marriage. But from a financial exposure standpoint...
And these sources are all focusing on the debt. What about disclosure of assets?
Right, so there's no...
Disclosure of assets. This is why we don't need disclosure of debts, because they're not liable for each other's business.
Right, so this goes to the last source that I bring in this sequence. Take a look at number 19. The last line of number 18 is just to tell you that if a woman is married to a man and then gains a debt, the husband is also not responsible for that. But take a look at 19. The 19 is a section of Shulchan Aruch that talks about the husband's rights to peros on her property. So this is a very interesting halacha. It's straight out of a Mishnah in Ksuvos in the beginning of the 8th parak. The rule is that in the event that she marries her husband, and there's property that the husband has rights to, he gets the peros, but she sells it off, the husband can reverse the sale. However, when is that true? B'nechasim hayiduim labal, only if he knows about the property. If she gains property and the husband doesn't know about it, lo simkor, she shouldn't sell it off. However, jumping the parentheses, v'machra kodem anisu and mechra kayim. If she sells it before the marriage, the sale is valid, even if it was after the kiddushin. And then it says, nachasim she'enam yiduam labal, property that is not known to the husband, kisha yivadu lo miyad nasu nechsem alok. When he finds out about it, it becomes nechsem alok. But until he knows about it, it's not his. If she sells it before he finds out about it, the sale is binding. I shouldn't have skipped the parentheses, because that's the line. V'machra osam kodem sheyeda bahem mechra kayam. So you're asked a question about non-disclosure of assets. The answer is what you don't know won't hurt you.
Well, you don't know, yeah.
But no, but if she sells it, the sale is actually binding. She has the ability to do that. So...
You
yeah.
take
a
tshuva, the standard form of tshuva, don't change anything, but can you add something to it?
So that is...
By disclosure of assets and schedule.
Right. So Ashkenazim have tended to be very, very reticent about amending anything within the tshuva in recent times. Sephardim have a lot of fun. If you ever go to a Sephardi wedding and they sing the Ksuba, you know, you hear that, you know, all sorts of stuff that they've inserted there. To the point where the insertions have now become ossified as part of the Ksuba. But the trend in the Ashkenazi community is to be very, very afraid of tampering with the Ksuba, lest you mess something up. The most obvious example of this was the Lieberman Clause, where the conservative movement wanted to include the prenup idea, which has become standard practice in many circles, very positively, as a standalone thing, right? Two clauses. Number one, if we have an issue, it'll be arbitrated in such and such based in. And number two, in the event that they're living apart, so our mezonos payment will be established as such and such a sum. Right? And we're very comfortable with that as a standalone document. The conservative movement said, let's do that as part of the ksuba. And the Orthodox in North America said, by no means, we don't want you to do that. There's a lot of reticence surrounding amending the ksuba. I just want to make sure to get to the last point, because those are two technical problems. First of all, we have the overall problem of lack of buy-in to the ksuba, overarching. But the technical problem, the parties didn't sign, there's no disclosure requirement, and the number three, the financial terms of the ksuba won't be recognized within the secular system. And I brought you a couple of articles that state that very clearly. One from Rabbi Breit and Rabbi Reese, the ksuba in America. No one knows what Zuzin and Zukukin are. Or as they put it, they're not to be considered sufficiently specific to be enforceable, as well as the absence of an English text. And the absence of signatures, you know. There is, in a footnote there, in number 20, the footnote 80, some rabbis have devised a legitimate solution, translate the ksuba document to English, that everybody will be accountable and will understand its meaning. So this is an attempt to try to address that problem. If you flip the page to number 21...
Forget about the secular part.
I'm down to 3 minutes.
But we have no idea what it's worth.
Then what does it mean in halakha also? Yeah. Correct. No, they should be explaining it. It's absolutely true. But here you run into source number 21, where Professor Salavi points out and I brought this whole thing because I thought she said it very well. There are numerous reasons for asserting that the ksuba is not analogous to other antinuptial agreements. Disregarding the fact that most antinuptial agreements are freely negotiated at arm's length and are written in a language both parties understand, the primary problem lies with the party's intent at the time of contracting. Courts have recognized that in some situations there is a presumption that no legal obligations will arise from the transaction, and so an unusual manifestation of intention is necessary to actually create a binding contract. You have to show you're serious. Because by default, we assume that you are not serious. Courts have recognized that there exist a few situations in which the typical intent is not to create an enforceable contract, such as in social, intra-family, and arguably religious settings. Since the marital setting fits into these categories, the presumption that the parties did not intend the religious Hebrew document to be binding holds true. That's the concern that we have, that they don't actually intend to get married, even before you get into the problem of what is a zuz. I've said at times in the past, well, after all, Chag Gadya, you can buy a yearling goat with tzuzuz, so presumably it's 100 yearling goats. And you valued by Professor Murray Schachter at the Allentown Fair at one point at $75 for for such a goat. So that means that it's 75 times 100. But they give you here, based on the quantities of silver, the range of options. And in source number 22, Rabbi Burit and Rabbi Reis lay down very nicely, based on August 6, 2002, the value of a troy ounce of silver at that point. And assuming you're going with 99% silver versus going with 87.5%, you know, what the numbers could be, you can see there's a very wide range of possible conclusions here for what it's worth. So we have a lot of problems here with this. It's not in English. They're not accepting it. The conditions aren't even written. Some of the conditions aren't even written, right? Some of the conditions involved, the Tanai based in, are binding even though they're not recorded in the Ksuba. So for all of these reasons, it's really hard to see a ksua being litigated in secular court, even if, to go back to the beginning, we have a concept of wanting to have the ksuba balance things in a way that's very acceptable within modern society. Nonetheless, the specifics of the ksuba make it really, really hard to ever see it going in a secular court. Shkarach, thank you.